Firstly, let me introduce myself. I'll be chairing this roundtable discussion. My name is Professor Mick Cox, or Michael Cox. I'm one of the directors of the Centre, which has been one of the sponsors and supporters of this excellent project today, Ideas. And welcome to you all. I know some of you have been here all day, and it's the end of a long day, but we hope to keep you awake, and with three very fine speakers here this evening. Just a very quick apology from Robert Wade. He cannot be here. He's going to try and get over here as quickly as possible. He was, as they say, otherwise detained, not by the British police, but just otherwise detained. But anyway, he's on his way. We hope he's on his way, and we'll join the discussion, hopefully, towards the end, if that is possible. In the meanwhile, we've got three excellent, outstanding speakers. Firstly, Mr. Andrew Dean, who will kick off. Andrew's director of the OECD Country Studies Branch, the Economics Department. And he'll be looking at the distinction between emerging and advanced economies in this crisis and how the crisis is impacting very differently on both. This will then be followed by a colleague of mine from Oxford, although it says Cambridge, I noticed on his tab here. He's going to sue LSE for that, he said. But there we go. We'll talk about that later on with a serious disciplinary action to follow. But anyway, Lawrence is still at Oxford. And he's still a senior research fellow, and he's still at Nuffield College, and he's still a very good speaker. And he'll be speaking on some of what kind of crisis is this, what kind of lessons to be drawn, and of course, given Lawrence's own expertise and background on Latin America and what is to be learnt there. And last but by no means least, my good friend, Dr. Munir Majid, visiting senior fellow with us in Ideas, who participates and helps direct the Southeast Asia International Affairs Programme. Majid should be known to many of you. Majid crosses over between the academic and the policy world very, very successfully. Has a PhD from the LSE, I always like mentioning that. And Majid, obviously, his great area of expertise, but not his only area of expertise, of course, is Southeast Asia, but he says he'll be saying a lot more. So we welcome all the three speakers we have. Welcome to sum up this session, to draw all the threads together, and, of course, to provide us with clear and neat solutions to the crisis. Not. So, we shall begin with you, Andrew. And we'll all speak from the table. Andrew, about 20 minutes each.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. And it is a pleasure for me to be here at this LSE event. And I'm grateful to LSE for organizing it. And I was actually hoping to meet a couple of the other sponsors, a couple of Australian sponsors, David Morgan and Ros Kelly, because I used to work on Australia at the OECD, and so I used to visit Australia quite a lot. And David Morgan was working at the Treasury a long time back before he did other things at the IMF and became a banker. But I gather some of you must know him.
Fingers are tapping. It's the very sensitive microphones they've got.
So, it's okay. Anyway, the punchline of my talk, I'll just give you quickly. As was mentioned, I'm going to talk about the way in which this crisis has been different from other ones. It's been a homegrown one in the advanced economies and not one that's happened because of the emerging market economies. In fact, the emerging market economies have been not exactly insulated, but they've come through the crisis rather better than the advanced economies. Of course, not all the emerging market economies are the same. They're very different. There are large differences between them. Policies in the advanced economies have been necessary to support global economic activity, but these policies have also had some downsides for the emerging market economies. And it's clear that any further deterioration in the euro area, which actually we've just been forecasting in our latest economic outlook, is going to have serious consequences globally. So let me come back to the start, and in fact the main theme is that, as the title of the well-known book, I guess to you, is known, this time it's different. I mean, this time has not been the same as previous financial crisis during my lifetime. In fact, this has of course been the most serious financial and economic crisis probably during any of our lifetimes. But this one, compared to other crises, financial crises in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, this one has been one that has not started in emerging market economies. It started in the heart of the OECD economies. In fact, it started, I guess, the epicenter started with the US, And then, of course, it has spread since, and the worst spot at the moment is, of course, the euro area. The United States is actually, after a lot of action in the United States, including propping up all the banks, apart from one, the United States is actually doing not too badly, although slow compared to a normal recovery. There's been no general agreement on the causes of the financial and economic crisis that we've been having, but of course there have been lots of things that have been mentioned. I'm just going to go through a few of them. First of all, there's been, it did start in the US, but underlying all of that, there's been loose monetary policy for probably too long in the US. Which I think most people have probably admitted now, although maybe not, I mean, even Mr. Greenspan, but maybe not Mr. Bernanke yet. And then global imbalances, they played a role. It's interesting that back in the 1980s, I was actually doing work at the OECD on global imbalances, and at that time everyone thought a 3% of GDP deficit in the United States couldn't be sustained. Well, actually, it could be sustained for a very, very long time, but... because there was always the external financing, and there still has been external financing, which may be one of our problems. The fact that it's been too easy for the United States to finance budget deficits, to pay for external deficit. Economic policies in general were too loose through a period which I guess has now been called the Great Moderation by a lot of people. And then there was too little regulatory oversight, in particular in the financial markets. And so all of these things sort of combined together and interacted in what was pretty much a perfect storm, and interacted also with housing price booms in a lot of the countries in the advanced world, but also in some of the emerging market economies. So all of these were factors that hit the advanced economies, and they eventually led to the financial meltdown that we all know. It wasn't at the origin a fiscal crisis. Some people think that because we've got lots of fiscal problems at the moment, and everyone's focused very much on fiscal consolidation and so on, that it must have started off in the budget area. And we saw, interestingly, this morning when we were looking at different countries, that that's not true. Even of the countries with problems in Europe, it may have been true of Greece. It may have been true to some extent in Spain at one time. It wasn't really true in Ireland, where it was a banking problem related to the housing. It wasn't really true in Italy, where they kept relatively tight control on the fiscal deficit. But of course, what happened with the crisis is the budget deficits got worse everywhere, and this was partly deliberate because, of course, the advanced economies piled in money to sort of staunch the bleeding in 2000, and especially in 2008, 2009, and that's where the serious impact on the budget deficits happened, and of course debt rose, and we've been having problems with that ever since. But it wasn't a fiscal crisis to start with, but it's developed into one, especially in Europe, where there's been a vicious interaction between the sovereign and the banking debt, and we've seen what happened to spreads, which thankfully are coming a little bit more under control or more reasonable. The emerging market economies were not at the origin of the dislocations and financial collapse. But they got, I might say, they got sort of sideswiped by what was going on elsewhere. The global crisis that started in mid-2007 and then got dramatically worse in 2008 halted the process of international integration, both financially and on the trade side. So both trade and capital flows were hit pretty severely. In fact, global capital flows dried up. I mean, that was one of the big problems. They dried up. I mean, confidence went out of the system. No one could trust banks, even in their own country. The banks didn't trust each other. And so global capital flows just dried up. And, of course, this did have knock-on effects on the emerging market economies. And that was very serious for a time. Of course, trade also collapsed, and I guess global world trade went down by about a quarter. But at least trade was still going on as it needed to. Now, although many of the emerging market economies suffered as capital flows dried up, basically, and this is a generalization, of course, basically, their financial systems were mostly far less affected because they'd never become very developed in the financial sectors. They hadn't got into esoteric products. They weren't mostly terribly open to cross-border banking flows. They weren't subject to all of the developments in the financial sectors in America, in the United Kingdom, in Europe, that caused so many problems. There'd basically been no major expansion of cross-border activity by the banks in the emerging market economies, but with some exceptions. I mean, I am generalizing and caricaturing the situation somewhat. So that there wasn't the sort of sudden drying up of domestic banking activity in some of these countries that you got in the advanced economies. Now, of course, not all the emerging market economies are the same, and there have been large differences across both countries and regions. The degree to which these countries were hit depended to a large extent on the nature of their financial linkages, the degree of openness of the economies, and the economic policies in place. But suddenly, as a group, it was the emerging market economies that have actually been the locomotive through the crisis. It's been really rather extraordinary. It's been a reversal of roles. And you can actually see this sort of quite interestingly in our latest forecasts. I mean, I'll just give you a couple of numbers. The growth rates for 2013 and 2014 as we see them. For the OECD economies as a group, we see 1.5% growth followed by 2.5% growth, just broadly speaking. For the world economy, we see something like 3.5% growth in 2013, followed by 4.25% growth in 2014. The non-OECD economies have been growing much, much faster than the OECD economies, even though they've been going through downturns. And we have figures for world trade growth picking up from a really dismal year this year of 3% growth to something like 7% by 2014. Of course, there have been concerns about China. China has slowed down. It has been hit by what's been happening to trade. The Chinese actually tried to slow down their own economy because they were worried about inflation. Now that's reversed. But, I mean, we have a forecast for growth in China of 7.5% in 2012. Obviously, a growth rate that Europeans would die for. And we do have a pickup. We're perhaps a little bit more optimistic than others. We've got a pickup to 8.5% and 9% in the next 2 years. Now, what's interesting is that this whole process of the imbalances is gradually being sorted out. I mean, on the current account imbalance side, and it was mentioned previously, I think it was mentioned by Christian in the previous session. I mean, the Chinese current account surplus was 10% of GDP, of its GDP, in 2007, and we have it's now down to 3% of GDP this year, and we have a forecast of it coming down to 2.25% of GDP in 2014. But, you know, there's deleveraging taking place everywhere. It's perhaps advanced a bit more in the United States, which is why they're actually able to recover a bit more. And that is going to provide sort of continuing headwinds in the world economy. Now, turning to policies and the policies that were adopted. The policies in the advanced economies were necessarily put into sort of full gear in 2008, I think in terms of what we were talking about earlier, you know, Keynesianism lived. People realized that this was very, very serious. A lot of money was put in. The monetary policy brakes were taken off, and fiscal policies were put into sort of overdrive in order to try to stop the bleeding. And that was fine for a time. You know, eventually the party has to come to an end, and we can have disputes about when the right time to sort of start easing off tightening the policy would be. But in fact, now we have the advanced economies, a lot of them, certainly the ones in Europe, trying to tighten up, even though there is extremely loose monetary policy, and it is still possible to do more on the monetary policy side, and actually we would recommend it in Europe. But, you know, there is this legacy of extremely high debt levels. I mean, it is really rather extraordinary. For the OECD as a whole, public sector debt as a share of GDP was 75% in 2007. It's now over 100%. In fact, it's 109% in 2012. We've got the US at 110% debt-GDP ratio, the UK 105%, Japan at 215%. But, of course, the irony here, and that's why people think actually there could be a little bit more ease in some of these countries, that would be the argument put by the less austerity people, is that the interest rates are extremely low in all of these countries, in Japan, in the UK, in the US. And the question is, I mean, that's the question, if there was more easing and more money was pumped in at the moment, what would happen to those interest rates? So, I mean, fiscal positions do remain a concern, but so does monetary policy. I mean, interest rates are at historically low levels, and we've had this quantitative easing. And this has had some effect in the emerging market economies as well, because, of course, there was a flow. Every time there's more QE, you tend to find that there's more money flowing into some of the emerging market economies who don't want to have the capital inflows because it's driving their exchange rates up. And so there's been this issue and talk about, you know, currency wars. And, I mean, beyond that, there's the issue of China and its exchange rate, although, as Christian mentioned earlier, the exchange rate has appreciated somewhat, but it would probably be better to see it floating more freely than it's allowed to. So, currently the euro area is in recession. We've got a few simulations in the economic outlook about what has actually happened as far as the effects of the euro area being in recession on the emerging market economies. And I'll just tell you those quickly, and then I will wrap up. What's happened is that euro area imports from the emerging market economies have gone down. They have gone down by about 3% in the last year. But euro area countries' imports from India and South Africa have gone down by 14% over the last year, from Russia and Indonesia by 9%, from China by 6%, from Brazil by 3%. So these trade links are pretty important. And of course, when the euro area is in recession, they're importing fewer goods, someone is exporting less. And so it's taken the wind out of the sails of world trade, basically. And so what started as being a really serious problem in the US and then got transferred to Europe and to some other places is now really in Europe. This is where the problem is. This is where the solution needs to be found. Although, of course, there are all these other things to do with financial regulation and so on and so forth that still need to be looked after. The effect is that of the slowdown in growth in, say, South Africa, for instance, three-quarters of that has come from its trade with the euro area. In the slowdown in growth in China, one-quarter comes from the euro area. And that's before thinking about what's been happening as far as sort of more dynamic effects are concerned. That's a very static sort of calculation. And before looking at the financial channels. So I think to wrap up, I'll just mention one thing, and that is how we see things now as far as the risks are concerned. I mean, unfortunately, we still see downside risks on the euro area. Even though there's been an agreement on Greece, it may not be an agreement that solves things for good, and I think there's a lot of comment about that out there in the markets and in the newspapers. And as we heard this morning, things go really rather slowly in Europe, and it always seems to be a little bit too little too late, although by now there's been a lot of action, and one could sort of regard it as a glass half full, not a glass half empty. And one could say the Europeans are finally getting all the bits and pieces in place, but it's going to take a long time to get to, say, a fiscal union, which is what you would eventually need if you want to have a properly functioning monetary union, and also a banking union. And, of course, we're here in London on the outside of the euro area, and London's not very keen on some of those issues. One final point that I will just mention is that, and it's actually mentioned by Andrew Gamble earlier on, I mean, we're not out of the woods yet, and he was talking about a long, drawn-out standoff, and I think that's quite right. But in thinking about what's happening in Europe, it struck me during the earlier session that, well, in Europe, what are we talking about? Are we talking about Europe and more European action being the problem or being the solution? And I think it's the solution. I think more needs to go on in the European Union in finding the solution. But there were some people talking this morning, I guess it was Mary Caldor and some of the others, who were talking about it as if Brussels and Europe was the problem. I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of pretty pro-European. I live the other side of the channel, so I'm not cut off when there's fog in the channel. So I think more needs to be done in Europe. And I was interested when I was thinking about Mary talking about the various protest movements and so on, that there had been protest movements against the IMF in earlier times. There had been protest movements against the G20 when they were meeting in London, famously. But there haven't actually been that many, protests against the ECB or the European Commission and. Of course, you do get sort of protesters out in the street if Mr. Barroso visits Greece and things like that. But I haven't noticed that sort of pent up feeling about protesting about the European Union. And I think they need to get their act together a little bit more rapidly and with a little bit more intensity. And I think that would help the rest of the world.
Okay, thank you very much. That sets the scene very well, Andrew. Thank you very much. Concise to the point. And straight on to you, Lawrence.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to thank LSE Ideas and the organisers, and thanks Francisco and co. for giving me the chance to hear this very interesting and wide-ranging day's debate, or at least as much of it as I could get to. And the problem at the last session is to try and extract certain categories or certain highlight certain aspects of it that one can take away. So here's what I want to take away. The first question would be, what kind of crisis is it? I've heard different comments about that, and the possibilities include, I think, Stephanie saying it's a North Atlantic crisis, Andrew just stressing that it's an OECD, more or less the same point, it's an OECD, not an emerging markets crisis. Some people who've been talking about it as basically a Eurozone crisis. And I'm still tempted to say that although it has its current location mainly in Europe, the international repercussions of it cause me to hesitate to give it a geographical confined location. I mean, things that Andrew has just said were quite interesting from that point of view. Well, he was making the point that it's not the same for the emerging markets. He's very helpful and insightful about the way in which things that may have happened and may happen in the core countries can spill over in a serious way to other countries. He pointed out that there was a global, in 2008, sudden stop of capital movement. That was a global aspect to it rather than a purely OECD focused. And it seems to me that it's too early to tell whether this is going to be a geographically constrained or a wider crisis. But certainly, it's lasted already 4 years, and as the forecasts for next year are indicating, it's going to be 5 years, and then there's been discussion, after all, about for some time in 2010, 2011, when the recovery was apparently going on, people kept saying we have to have a faster recovery because of to avoid stall speed. Well, I mean, I think we have to recognize that if we're going to use that metaphor, we are looking at stall speed in the most important components of the world economy this year and next. And so that raises the question, does the whole structure stay in the air? How far before the stall speed really produces a second and perhaps more serious spiral to what we already have. I don't think we know. I'm not predicting. I don't want to be saying I'm predicting that it's bound to be a global disaster, but I don't think we can seriously, we can't leave that out of our discussion. So what kind of a crisis? There's the geographical scope of it. There's other things that have been discussed. Is it a financial crisis? Is it an economic crisis? There's been some signs of the geopolitical aspects of the crisis getting discussed. And I think it was particularly helpful and important to hear Andrew Gamble proposing using the crisis of the fiscal state, old literature, and saying, well, actually, it may be a fiscal state crisis. Obviously, different aspects of that can be followed and have been followed up by different speakers. I think that from the point of view of the title of this conference, which is the political aspects of financial crisis, it's very important to consider the fiscal state side of it, which would mean that the politics came much more to the fore, shall we say, not rather than the more technical and financial questions. And then Andrew also said crisis is one of those words that can be overused, and as Andrew's just mentioned, Andrew Gamble said, and as Andrew Dean has just said, the alternative phrase that was proposed was a long, drawn-out standoff. I'm tempted to think that really what we might be needing to think of from a political point of view is protracted international economic stress, something like that. And then we need to ask ourselves, what's the role of politics in such a situation? And I think that there are two distinct, analytically distinct questions which it's worth sorting out. There's what's the role of politics? How did politics affect responses to this condition of protracted economic stress? That's one side of it. And there's a second, related but distinct question, how did this protracted economic stress affect politics? Now, obviously, the two interact, and over time, it's maybe harder and harder to separate them out. But I think it is important analytically to recognize those two sides of it and to think of them for purposes of explanation. Think through the logic of, first of all, the one and then the other, and then, if you like, how they connect. Well, they're both very big questions. The question how politics affects the management of economic crisis has many different aspects to it. I just want to pull out one which is intended to be illustrative of a range of things that one would need to think of in that area, but which I think is quite well illustrated by today's discussions. It's the question of nation states as the political deciding units in an international economic environment where the leverage of even the largest nation states is limited, and most of the nation states we're talking about, there's great asymmetries in power and in influence between them. Certainly if we look at countries like Greece and so on, we're talking about countries which are very minor from the point of view of the global system, but the kind of political problems that they face and the kind of political possibilities that they may follow can have much wider international repercussions. Well, I'm going to make a quick comparison with Latin America in 1982 along the following lines. One of the things that was technically possible after the 1982 continent-wide Latin American debt crisis, theoretically, whether or not it would have been a good thing, all the Latin American countries might have got together, formed a debtors' cartel, and told the bankers, this is what we're prepared to offer, and no more. This was a proposal that you could find lots of authors and political activists advocating, and it was something that simply didn't happen. So from a political explanation point of view, why didn't it happen? I would say fundamentally because Latin America was a conjunction, a conglomeration of states of different sizes, different interests, different political profiles, competing against one another. And that in the end, whatever the rhetoric or whatever the beginnings of, you know, bluffing and bargaining might be, when it came down to it, each government was almost, perhaps inevitably, but certainly, whether inevitably or not, was very strongly politically constrained to act in pursuit of what it perceived as its interests, even if that meant lack of solidarity with other countries. And so there was competition in that way. Maybe it was a mistake, maybe it was a lost opportunity, but political realities limited how the crisis could be dealt with. And I would say that that's a relevant consideration when considering Stephanie's excellent technical proposal and proposals that you can find from other people about the desirability and perhaps the feasibility of the European Union as a whole responding to the crisis by reflating. It may be that that's the technically right thing to do. It may be that it wouldn't produce the bad results that are expected. After all, the European Union is a very large part of the world economy, and if you think of it as a unity, it's not in bad shape. The problems arise basically from the stresses and strains within the European Union rather than the European Union as a single entity. So compare the European Union with the United States. If the United States chooses to reflate as its way of getting out of the economy, it can then handle the internal distributive consequences and so on, and it has the political option to take that. The European Union doesn't have that political option, I would say, because essentially the federal or the Brussels part of it is 1% of the total GDP and so on. And we see instead, and this again is repeating a lesson from Latin America in 1982, that in the context of crisis, new reactions come to the fore, new political reactions. Countries and political parties and leaders and even public opinion become much more defensive, much more fearful. They're not prepared to take risks or be generous in the cause of a wider solidarity which may not pay off or may not be reciprocated because they feel they've got their backs against the wall. So the possibilities, even though it might be technically a good solution, the political realities of what you can do in terms of crisis response are severely handicapped in that way. Now, there are other ways also in which we could talk about political crisis, how politics affects crisis response. But my time's short. I'll just give that as an illustration. So now let's turn it the other way around, and let's look at how the crisis may affect politics. And again, I want to take the 1982 Latin American debt crisis, even though it was a regional crisis, and in some ways it was less terrible than we could be facing in the present situation because there was a healthy international economy to which the Latin Americans could adjust. It was a question of coming to terms with the rest of the world, whereas in this case the whole world has to come to terms with its internal problems. At any rate, the first thing that's very striking from a political comparative politics point of view is, contrary to what people expected, although the 1982 crisis in Latin America was painful and protracted, it resulted in a lost decade, it resulted in a great deal of social movement protest, a great deal of fear and anxiety, a great deal of lowered expectations and damaged lives. Actually, from a broad political point of view, and now I'm not looking at 4 years of it, I'm looking at a decade or 2 decades of it, the outcome of that crisis, I'm not saying totally caused by the crisis, but in tandem with that crisis, there was a region-wide shift from authoritarian governments, which were inward-looking in their economic strategies and statist, and from Andrew Gamble's point of view, they were suffering the problems of the fiscal state. There was a mismatch between what they needed tax revenues to finance and what the tax revenues were available, and they tried to cover that up by sovereign borrowing, and the sovereign borrowing had run out, tried to cover it up by inflation, and the inflation got worse. And then during the 1980s they had to shrink. Maybe it wasn't good, but they did in fact shrink the size of the fiscal activities of the state, and finally, after 10 years, they reduced it to the size that the then existing market players, his second household, were willing to finance. And that's to say that, on the one hand, the debt crisis was accompanied by a shift to democratization. Good, if you like, shows that political regimes could be improved, even in very adverse economic circumstances. But on the other hand, we need to look at the kind of democratization that that gave rise to. It's not just a question of political consequence regime change, it's also a question within each regime, a whole series of other things changed. For example, I would say there was a great shift in the balance of power away from producer groups, if anything, towards the empowering of consumers. There was a considerable shift from, obviously, the trade unions were practically liquidated, public employees were greatly weakened, and the private and particularly the financial sectors, internationalized financial sectors, were greatly enhanced. There was also a shift in the composition of the what people have been calling the political class. There was the rise of technocrats, and there was the rise of a specialized breed of politicians who were vote-getting politicians with a different mandate from the kind of people who'd ruled Latin America before. So you had a restructuring. It was democratization. It was partly attributable, not entirely attributable to the debt crisis, but the debt crisis, it was compatible with and in some ways reinforced by the pressures from the debt crisis. And it was not only a regime change, but also a neoliberal restructuring. So, was that the end of the story? Does that mean that we expect all crises to end in end of history time? No. I would say at this point there are several caveats to the Latin American story which are relevant if we're looking at the long-term outcome of where we are now. One is that it took a long time. It took a decade. A lot happened in that decade. What we're seeing in Europe and in other parts of the world is the equivalent of where Latin America had got to by 1984 or 1985, 86 at most, and that's not the end of the story at all. So there's a lot more in terms of political restructuring still to come. The restructurings didn't suppress everything that existed before, so 20 years later you start seeing old political reflexes and patterns and interests reappearing again. They haven't completely gone. They were just pushed from the stage temporarily by the severity of the economic crisis. And I think that may be a very important factor to look for in the long run with this one as well. The outcomes were really quite heterogeneous. So there was no simple return to a status quo ante, and there was no single unitary outcome which was stable for all countries. Just compare, you know, the Venezuelan outcome, which was based on their being able to shelter themselves because of their oil, the Mexican outcome, which was based on them being able to put themselves into the North American free trade area, the Argentine outcome, which was a continuation of their long traditions of being a serial defaulter, and so on. You can see very heterogeneous responses, but it takes a long time period for the Andrew Gamble-type adjustment, which he talked about, in which the fiscal state has to be scaled back down to the point where it's in the stable equilibrium with the private market. It took a long time, and that took a lot of substantive items of restructuring. It wasn't just a simple aggregate reduction. The restructurings involved, first of all, radical changes in expectations of different social groups. Mm. And we've been talking about that in relation to the very different changes that young people can expect from the political economy of their country as compared to the older generation. And there are many other examples of radical changes of expectations. Radical changes in institutional structure, and I'm going to illustrate that as my final point. Also, a very far-reaching change in the ideational framework. The ideas that prevailed in Latin America in the 1970s were, well, I won't repeat them all, but they had a whole coherent logic to them, and they guided a lot of policy choices, and they were liquidated. And it took a considerable amount of time before, until a substitute coherent pattern of ideas gained the necessary ascendancy. That was the neoliberal or liberal international experience across Latin America in the 1990s. Those changes in ideas were also changes in the composition of the political class. So the technocrats, for example, would be the people who had the necessary international credentials and the necessary commitment and understanding to turn general neoliberal ideas into specific policy proposals that could be implemented and that, where they could find the coalitions of support and they could find the international support. So it took a long time and it required a lot of detail for the old model to be replaced by a new one. It took 10, 20 years. And I think that we're at a present stage where a lot of the old ideas of pre-2008 are discredited. But, and there are interesting ideas such as the ones that Stephanie's put forward, that could be the germs of something else. But we are far, far from having the knitting together of a coherent combination of these ideas, institutions and expectations so that they can be mutually supporting and steering in a post-crisis or post-stress situation. And I think that's going to take a long time, and I think in particular, almost done, in particular because I have a heading which I'll take up in discussion, if you like, about inertia of dominant ideas. It takes a much longer to subject institutionally embedded orthodoxies to criticism and to really replace them than simply to they have to be replaced by a next generation trained according to a different set of ideas, who have a different sources of socialization, who have different modus operandi and who have different sources of social support. And that's why, unfortunately, although I'm very attracted to Stephanie's general position, I don't see the political conditions coming together for some time yet to follow the route that she would favour. And therefore I fear that for political reasons rather than for, because they're technically wrong, we will continue a bit longer on the course that we have been following.
Thank you very much, Lawrence. Lots of food for thought. Munir, please. You just turned it off. That's fine.
Right, thanks, Mick. Well, as part of the ideas family, I'm happy to make my little contribution to the discussion. But let me warn you, I'll be coming at it from the Southeast Asian perspective and through a Southeast Asian experience. I will not go over common ground that has been gone through, but I'll highlight our experience and perspective as we have felt them since the 97-98 crisis. I notice we only have about 30 diehards still with us, and some of them are wilting like the Eurozone countries, and therefore I will be making some really challenging remarks. First of all, I think markets, we've been talking about markets, and I'd like to give my experience of markets as we went through the crisis in 98. I was chairman of the Malaysian Securities Commission, and we were just starting the commission. I was a founding chairman of the commission. And the exuberance does not quite describe the wildness that attended to the markets when they rose. And this was fueled by portfolio capital coming into the markets, particularly the stock markets, and fueled by Western research houses, which wrote copious reports on how good these markets were. Notably, of course, leading these reports were Baring Brothers. Where are Barings now? I worked with Barings too myself, and it replaced completely private capital flows, replaced almost wholly in Southeast Asia the public capital flows that used to be the genre before then, and everyone was so happy that the markets were going up, and it was not, however, a good time to set up the Securities Commission because you're putting in controls and regulations which people don't like, particularly the stock market, which has been controlled by a newly formed Securities Commission, which is trying to control the private members' club, the way stock markets used to operate before. And, of course, you find that when you have to do something in imposing and introducing regulation, like acting or arresting some people who might be doing silly things in the markets, including short selling, which was not allowed at that time in Malaysia. We arrested one chap very close to the Prime Minister of Malaysia. He should have been locked up, but he got away with a fine. And people were getting fed up with these kinds of things that we had to do because it was disturbing. You know, this great roaring 90s, as Stiglitz calls it. And so it was not an easy time, but the power of the market, the enthusiasm of the people who drove the markets is unbelievable. And there was a mix, a association. The main people involved are the brokers, intermediaries in driving the market up. But insofar as particularly the stock market is concerned, there was a close nexus between brokers and politicians. There's one way of passing value through one to the other by using the stock market. And so it was not a good time to set up market. Even corporates were talking about, we can't have a squeaky clean financial system. How dare you try and do this stuff? And so there was, well, actually, now when markets turn, sort of funds were moving the other way around and getting out of the door pretty quick, they were looking for people to blame, obviously. And regulators do get the blame, and regulators too deserve the blame, because regulators did not fully understand the force of the market. And two of the things that happened was the liberalization of a capital account by the regulators was not done with any particular measure of its potential cost. And I think that was one clear lesson I drew from it, because the central bank or whatever decided to liberalize the capital market, and we are small markets, and when funds were moving in and out in that kind of size, in that kind of amount, you know, it does affect market badly. Of course, as funds rushed out, regulators were blamed and so on and so forth, but those who rushed the funds out also started talking about poor corporate governance, let's say, you know, in Malaysia. Or they talked about borrowing to fund property market in Thailand, which they knew about when they first sent the funds in. These same foreign fund managers, when they moved in, corporate governance was at a certain level. I'm not saying it was perfect or good. Or when they lend the money to the property speculators, they knew what they were doing. So, but when they got out, they used that as ex post facto rationalization, you know, to say that this is the reason. So markets are, you can't handle them. You know, they come in and they go out and they use reasons which are abstracted sometimes, half real, half true, and a mix of reasons to justify such movements. And so that was the market. The force of the market and how it can affect small markets, particularly in Southeast Asia, and how it affected it at that time. And, of course, after all this has happened, there's got to be a lot of repair work to get those fund managers back, to get those flows in again, to rebuild the economy. I was taken just now by someone talking about how austerity measures are being forced on Spain or Greece, and how rules-based decision in financial market management is not democratic. But Southeast Asia in 1998 faced rules-based decision-making in financial management. You remember the austerity demands that were made on Indonesia. Of course, many of us remember Michel Comdesu standing over President Suharto, signing away Indonesia's management of its economy and its financial system. It caused Suharto finally to fall. A change of government in Indonesia, you know, which is 240 million people now. And here we are talking in Europe about austerity measures. Oh, my God. You know, talking about rules-based financial management decisions. Now, it happened in Southeast Asia. We are sometimes self-absorbed when we are elsewhere about what happened before some other places. And these things were actually forced upon Southeast Asia. Of course, dear old Dr. Mahathir, who we tried to get, sort of went against the market. So his authoritarianism worked in a way that he could will the economy to move against the market. He could tell me off. He could impose all sorts of controls himself on the capital market, on the stock market, which was done. It was an easy time for me, I must tell you. Yet, you know, when it worked at the macroeconomic level, all the things he did are being repeated today. Will have been repeated since 2008, have been repeated in Europe since then, in the Eurozone crisis, moral hazard, nationalization of banks, you know, all those things that we were told, don't touch, you must never do it. And he did it. Don't interfere with the market. He did it. And so he bucked the trend. And it worked, and Malaysia did not go the Indonesian way, because Indonesia went with the IMF, the Indonesian way. So when today, you know, the unconventional conventions, or conventional unconventional, whatever it is, have become, you know, the rule of the market, the rule of management of crisis. When markets are under threat, when economies are under threat. So it's not just a matter of double standards, it's how people address their issues and forget about how others had to address them before. Talking about lessons drawn, and this is a subconscious lesson drawn, if you like, how Mahathir managed the crisis is being used almost wholly in managing the Western, the Western crisis. I would describe the crisis from point of origin, although its impact can be geographically wider. And so there can be lessons drawn a bit about it, and there were experiences, both political, economic, and financial, in Southeast Asia, which were not dissimilar, which were worse than what Europe is going through for those particular countries concerned. Just take Indonesia as an example. Of course, the Greek instance of minus 20% growth and so on is obviously the worst in the world. But those countries in Thailand, Indonesia, they went through hell as well. And at securities market regulation, international securities market regulation level, IOSCO, International Organization of Securities Commissions, and I was a chairman of the Emerging Markets Committee of IOSCO, to be a force, to be part of the technical standards setting committee, the technical committee of IOSCO. There was no emerging market represented on the technical committee of IOSCO at that time. So here we are talking about rules of transparency, regulatory rules, and international regulation, of standards of regulation, and there was no representation at all. I fought my way in to make sure that EMC, the Emerging Markets Committee, had one representative in a committee of nine, I think it was.
When?
This was 1998. We came out with a report, the Emerging Markets Committee came out with a report on the crisis, 97-98, including a very strong point about how hedge funds are not regulated, how they are not transparent. Until today, the hedge fund issue is still outstanding. And in the 1998 IOSCO annual conference in Nairobi, IOSCO refused to accept this document of ours as an official document, just noted it. It's been subsequently accepted as time goes by. Subsequently accepted, but at that time they refused. And in 1999, at a meeting in Paris, I had a big row with some developed country regulators about some of whom we know, about hedge funds and what they do, and what we don't know about what they do. So it has been not an easy experience. So now here we are today, and we have the Western crisis, and I understand the point that was made by Professor Stepney, Griffiths, Jones, about not wanting to have a financial system develop so vastly in the emerging economies. I think I would take that point up to a point, in the sense that the correlation between the financial system and the real economy must not be lost, and it must not diverge so unbelievably as it has done in the West. And certainly in the development of the bond market, we do need the development of a nation bond market. There's so many infrastructure projects which are enormous, you know, which need to stay. So you need, if Southeast Asia from all its experience, or East Asia from all its experiences, wants to lessen the burden and impact of financial flows, outflows, inflows, it has to develop its own capital markets, bond markets, and integrate some of its smaller stock markets, have common settlement, and integrate them not into one market, but having cooperative arrangements for settlement, and Mick, you are very interested in power shift and so on, and I think there are two things that hold back the economic geoeconomic shift to the east. The two things that hold it back and which need to be addressed if it is to be underpinned and anchored into a real shift of other aspects of power would be financial markets must develop there as well. And secondly, of course, on my final point, Mick says I've only got 1 minute left, or is it less than 1 minute?
Less now.
Final point is it must develop the intellectual self-confidence to come up with its own ideas about standards, about markets, about macroeconomic management. It hasn't developed that capacity. And for as long as it doesn't develop that capacity, the Western intellectual tradition, I'm not saying it pejoratively, ipso facto, because of the dominance of Western markets, will actually dominate the way the world is run.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mignon. And Robert, over to you. To say whatever you would like to say in 10 minutes, if you might.
Well, I do apologise for not being here earlier. I forgot to cancel my office hours. That's the short of it, and I had a whole accumulation of students who...
You can unpress your button there. Yeah, that's better. Yeah.
Who could not be postponed.
No worries. Thanks for coming.
Let me just... perhaps take off the point that you made about intellectual self-confidence, or rather the need for intellectual self-confidence, to strike out on a different path. I'm going to refer to the Chiang Mai Initiative, as it's called. I hope you have not been talking about the Chiang Mai Initiative.
No, it's completely right. Original. It's
okay. So the Chiang Mai Initiative is often pointed to by people who don't know better as a good example of East Asian regional organization, the success of East Asian regional organization, in contrast to weaker regional organization elsewhere in the world. What is called the Chiang Mai Initiative is basically an arrangement of the ASEAN plus three countries to provide each other with access to emergency loans independent of the IMF. At least that was the idea. And this idea came out of the experience that the previous speaker referred to of the East Asian financial crisis, when governments across this region swore to themselves and to each other that they would never again allow themselves to be exposed to the arm twisting of the IMF, which they saw as the instrument of the U.S. Treasury. to the point where this crisis is known in that region as the IMF crisis rather than as the East Asian crisis, as we call it in the West. So they were very angry at being under IMF pressure and under pressure to do things that had nothing to do with getting out of the crisis, but everything to do with what the US Treasury wanted, had long wanted them to do by way of opening markets. And it seemed absurd to them that there were countries in this region which had overflowing foreign exchange reserves, and yet countries in crisis in the region, such as Malaysia and South Korea, could not get access to those reserves. So they set up this thing at a meeting in Chiang Mai and named it the Chiang Mai Initiative. But this was in 2000, right from the beginning, they did something which is completely paradoxical, looked at from the outside. Namely, they built into the arrangement to borrow, that is, the rules by which any one country in the region could borrow from another country's surplus foreign exchange reserves, they built into the rules what was called the IMF link. Namely, that a country, any one country that went into crisis could borrow only a very small amount of the total that it was permitted to borrow, like 10% of the total it was permitted to borrow. And if it wanted to borrow more than this very small amount, that country had to be under an IMF standby agreement. That was the IMF link. So this is completely paradoxical. The whole idea was to escape from the IMF, but they instituted a very tight IMF link, which brought the IMF straight back in, able to impose its own conditionality, even though the whole purpose was to escape this. So the question is why? Why did they build in an IMF link? And why does the IMF link continue to this day, even though they have considerably beefed up the whole thing with more resources and with more formal rules and so on? There is still this IMF link. And the reason has to do with moral hazard, in a word. And by that I mean the fear that... They agreed that even the access to the resources of the regional fund had to carry conditionality. It had to carry conditionality because if it was very easy for a country like Korea or Malaysia, whatever, to get very cheap emergency loans on very generous terms, then that would induce moral hazard on the part of the government. Namely, the government would run the economy very, very fast and ignore the dangers of going into crisis because it knew it had this backup of very cheap loans. So that's the moral hazard problem. Therefore, from the beginning, they instituted a form of regional conditionality that was less tough than the IMF and was also directly related to getting out of crisis in a way that the IMF conditionality was much broader. So the point is that the fund, they all recognized that the regional fund had to carry conditionality that borrowing governments would not like. Otherwise, it would be too easy for them. So then the question is, why the IMF link? Well, the worry was that if a country borrowed from the fund and was subject to the fund's own tough conditionalities, then one of the governments that had overflowing foreign exchange reserves, notably China or Japan, would go under the table and would lend to Korea if it was in crisis, or to Malaysia if it was in crisis, on very soft terms in order to curry favor with that government, bilateral favor. So it would undercut the conditionality from the regional fund. In order to avoid that, one country defecting from the common agreement and going under the table to buy support from bilateral support, in order to overcome that problem, they created the IMF link, which meant that the IMF had to be involved in anything more than small borrowing. It had to send its people in, it had to be monitoring the whole situation and stopping any kind of under-the-table deal. Well, they went on in 2007, 2009 to beef up this whole thing. They expanded and they made it actually a common fund. They expanded the amount that countries could borrow without going first to the IMF, but it's still pretty low, like only 30% now of the total permissible amount of borrowing. They established a secretariat. The government of Singapore immediately offered land and building, so that problem was solved. But there then remained two other big problems. One, who was to be the first president of the secretariat of the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization, because the beefed up version was called the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization, CMIM. The first question was who was to be the president, above all, which nation was the president to come from? And as you can imagine, China put up a candidate, Japan put up a candidate, ASEAN put up a candidate. ASEAN hoped that the distrust between China and Japan would be so strong that that would pave the way for the first president to be from ASEAN. But this issue of the president went on and on and on between the finance ministers. They could not agree, could not agree, could not agree. Eventually, it was the Chinese candidate was appointed as the first president. The second big problem was, what was the name of the secretariat? Everybody agreed on the acronym of the name, but they did not agree, and emphatically did not agree, on what that acronym spelt in English. The acronym was AMRO, and everybody agreed that A stood for ASEAN plus 3, M stood for macroeconomic, R stood for research, and O stood for organization. So if it's just taken at face value, it's ASEAN plus 3, macroeconomic research organization. No. And many people, above all the Chinese, wanted that to be the full spelling of AMRO. But other people said, no, that's not the full spelling. The full spelling is ASEAN plus 3, macroeconomic and research organization. They wanted to separate macroeconomic and research by putting an and in the middle. The reason for this was that these people wanted the secretariat to have a bigger role than the first set of people, including China, wanted. And by separating out macroeconomic from research, by putting the and in the middle, macroeconomic became a code for surveillance, mutual surveillance. And that meant surveillance by other people of China's exchange rate and other things to do with the Chinese economy. The Chinese said no. Our exchange rate is entirely our business. We don't want ASEAN or anybody else, let alone the Japanese, monitoring our exchange rate policy. We want AMRO to be only a research organization, a macroeconomic research organization, and that's why we do not want and between macroeconomic and research. And guess what? The official full spelling of AMRO is ASEAN plus 3 macroeconomic research organization, just as the Chinese wanted. So that's the story of AMRO, as far as I know it. Perhaps some others here know the most recent developments, although what I've been talking about is actually very recent. And then just the final point to make is what happened when Korea needed an emergency loan in 2010, what happened when Indonesia needed an emergency loan in is 2011, I think. Did they go to the Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization Fund? No, they did not. Korea went directly to the U.S. Federal Reserve, and Indonesia went directly to the Bank of Japan. So these two key countries in the Chiang Mai Initiative bypassed their own arrangement and did bilateral deals with the big, powerful countries of the region. And that's the end of my story.
That's the end of your story. It's a great story, too. I've never known such a story revolve around the word and.
Yes, exactly.
That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Now, I think we've got a lot of food for thought there. A number of things come to my mind. Maybe two very quick points. I mean, never let a good crisis go unused. And I suppose one of the questions that comes to my mind, thinking about the length of this crisis, is the extent to which the crisis, globally and regionally, is itself being used. In the case of the European Union, it seems to be pretty obvious. that many people are utilizing the crisis for a process of restructuring. I mean, one of the points that you made about Latin America was that the lengthy and very costly crisis to human economic potential itself throughout the 1980s did lead, at the end of the process, to restructuring, and a major restructuring. In other words, in the end, there were certain consequences of a lengthy crisis. In the same way, as you said, Munir, there were real consequences to the politics and the political economy of Southeast Asia as a result of the crisis. So I think the point I want to really drive home is that, you know, we kind of think crisis is almost being irrational. And it seems to me that we could equally think, without being conspiratorial about it, that crises themselves are processes of restructuring, reordering, recalibrating, and redefining what has gone before and bringing it to a new level. That's the kind of first point I want to make. The second point is, I mean, it's a general question to all the panelists, really, and we can open it up to you guys first, is how long does it go on? I mean, you know, when does a crisis stop being a crisis and you start calling it something else? I mean, a crisis has got to resolve itself either with the patient dying, if you kind of take it in the medical terminology, the patient just dies and that's the end of the crisis, or the patient gets better. Now, it's quite difficult for a patient to remain either undead or not very well forever and ever and ever. And the question that rises to my mind is, how long do you think this can go on? Because how long can Europe, for instance, sustain 40% unemployment amongst young people? How long can a whole bunch of social and economic consequences in Europe and elsewhere continue? It may well be, as I think you said, Andrew, that nobody's protesting against the EU, or maybe, and even the Greek left are not saying get out of the Europe. They're not saying get out of the euro. But they're protesting against something. I mean, how long can you maintain social cohesion in a country with the levels of unemployment that you're going to have? How long can you have it when pensions are being attacked and the standards of living of ordinary people, middle class and working class together, are being attacked? We are already beginning to see not only the social consequences, but the political consequences in Europe. Read the German press about Greeks. Read the Greek press about Germany. That's the beginning, not of the end of the euro or the eurozone, but it is a certain fragmentation of European identity. And even the movements towards independence in places like Catalonia and possibly even Scotland as well are themselves reflections of underlying tensions and forces, which if these underlying problems are not resolved, will, it seems to me, intensify over time. So you have social stress both within Europe and political stress, which is already manifesting itself as well. So it does seem to me that there's all sorts of interesting questions to be raised here, and you've raised many of them. I could go on and ask you all sorts of lots of questions. I could even ask give my own paper, but I'm certainly not going to do that. We've got about 20 minutes to go, so I think we should open it up for some Q&A. Could I have the first question, please? Please. Take a few. Yeah, use the mic.
Lawrence, presentation to raise a wider point. Lawrence, what you haven't talked too much in your presentation was about the role of the United States in solving the crisis. The United States was, you may like or not how the United States solved the crisis, but it did. It provided the Brady and Baker plan, it provided the new ideas, the coordinating mechanisms, etc., etc. So in terms of the collective action and coordinating problems of any crisis, we can say that the Latin American crisis has a G1 coordinator who was the United States. Yeah. If we move to the current crisis, the situation is very different. Yeah. Perhaps in 2008 to 2009, I can remember the G20 provided for a brief moment a coordination. But it seems now we are in a kind of G0 in terms of global coordination, not European coordination. And I wonder the panel can reflect a little bit about the lack of a global coordinator or coordinating mechanism for the crisis.
Thanks, that's a great question. Stephanie, please, yeah.
Yeah. I remember Pascal Lamy saying that the problem with this crisis was there was nobody in the cockpit. So that's exactly the same point. I wanted to ask comment really on what Lawrence said. He said, well, maybe the kind of more rational outcomes that I was trying to outline, like a better designed financial sector, better regulated, and a more Keynesian pro-growth strategy wouldn't happen. And I think that may be possible, but there are two problems with that. The first one is what the chair has just said, you know, that there's growing unemployment and lack of hope. The other thing is that Europe is not on its own. I mean, the emerging markets, as Andrew was saying, are growing very quickly, and they are very dynamic and investing a lot and expanding their universities and their science parks and all that, while we are cutting all the time. And so if Europe wants to kind of survive in a world economy, it does need to have some kind of growth response, not just in the sort of short-term demand management sense, but also in terms of restructuring and investing and so on. And only Germany seems to mainly be doing that. So if I may have another question, which is to Andrew. Dean, I mean, he was pointing to the fact how trade is slowing down as a result of the recession in Europe, and of course, if it continues or deepens, it will slow down even more. I think there is a beginning to be an emerging discussion in developing countries. People like José Antonio Campo are beginning to say, well, maybe if the age of very rapid trade growth will stop. Maybe the best strategies for developing countries will be to emphasize less export-led growth, more regional and domestic-based growth. And so that could lead to another change in the model. China maybe will be going that way anyway, which again would affect Europe, for example. So how would that play out? And a final point, if I may, I mean, one of the reasons, I think, which developing countries have been growing more is precisely because they have more space, because they have lower debt levels, but also they have a deeper commitment, more Keynesian policies. The Chinese and so on have actually had more expansionary policies. That's one of the reasons why they're growing.
Get back to your point about states. There's a lady there in green wants to ask a question. Sorry? Please, yeah, just briefly, if you could. Yeah. Yes. Oh, okay, fine. All right, I thought your hand was up, sorry. Okay, then. All right, okay. Mooney, why don't you begin, and I'll let all the panellists have a
go. I think of it more broadly. I mean, the Asian story is in danger of being undermined by political disputes and economic non-cooperation. The Chinese impact on Asian economies has been largely positive since the growth of China. And however, China is in danger of undermining this in respect of its actions in the South China Sea, very recent silly actions about passports, having the whole South China Sea within China in its image, and its actions, of course, physically, you know, in the South China Sea. Whereas at the last ASEAN summit, just a couple of weeks ago, there were lots of words expressed in terms of economic cooperation, in particular in terms of RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, comprising the 10 ASEAN countries and 6 other East Asian countries. This does not include America and the US, which are members of the East Asia Summit, which is 18. But this RCEP is only 16, minus those two. Now, the size, of course, of this regional bloc, it will be the largest, if it became effective, true, largest FTA area in the world, one-third of the world economy. Now, lots of nice words and lots of, you know, future plans, but possibilities of things, many a slip between cup and lip, and China's actions are quite critical in this. Just as in the CMIM, it is something that can or may not work if things do not come off. But the whole notion of the CMIM was actually started by China after the 97-98 crisis. But then when they put the money down, the Japanese and the Koreans also wanted to put the money down, you know, didn't want to be left out. And so they ended up with a 240 at the moment billion fund with all the cracks and problems that they have, the office, the AMRO office in Singapore and all that, and doing IMF-type surveillance, IMF-style macroeconomic surveillance. But as Robert was saying, I mean, there are many of these, a lot of this skullduggery going on, you know, the posturing and maneuvering that's going on, just as it is going on in the wider regional integrative aspect. Your point, however, I think is well taken. If Europe does not grow, America has got its links to this region, you know, through the TPP, the American pivot and all that, you know, and trying. But Europe, I sense, is rather less linked, you know, to this region. And then if we have an outcome where regional-based growth is going to be the driver of the world economy, and there really did happen to be regional cooperation in East Asia, then, you know, you have consequences in the model of world economic growth, as you suggested. I'll leave it there. I've got a few points, but okay, I don't want to talk too much.
Lawrence.
So, quickly, yes, Francisco, time precluded me from discussing the Brady Plan, but you're right that the whole restructuring was made coherent because it had a leadership and it had a centre of guidance. Mm. One might still ask oneself, why did it take so long? There was the Baker Plan in 1985, which would have done the same thing much more quickly. In fact, it took another 5 years, and that's relevant to how long we think this crisis is going to go on. The United States, there was an illusion in Latin America that maybe the worst was behind and we could get out of it. The United States was not ready to accept the write-downs. The Brady Plan only became possible when Ronald Reagan was completed his term, basically, and a new, more pragmatic team came in. Now, that's not irrelevant to thinking about where we are now. I'm not saying there will never be a solution to the current strain. But, by the way, Stephanie, I'm only saying I don't see it happening. The political conditions for it will take time to mature. That's my point. Now, one of the possibilities is that for all the reasons you describe, as Europe fails, as visibly the social consequences of doing the wrong thing become more and more painful, as Europe slips further and further behind the rest of the world, there are, of course, intelligent and well-placed people in Europe thinking, this is my chance. And there may well come a point where just like the United States said, the time has come, there may come a point where, from my point of view, I'd say the German political establishment and, in the end, public opinion need to accept that the money is lost. That's the implication of the write-down. And then you can create conditions from which growth can be restored. They're not psychologically, intellectually, institutionally, and so on ready, but that's going to take a while to explain why it doesn't happen in the way that a rational policymaker would wish it to happen. You need the political factors, which that's my principal point.
Thank you. Well, just quickly, can developing countries provide the locomotive or continue to do so? It's rather difficult because of this issue of global supply chains. And we just saw what happened when there was the Japanese earthquake, and suddenly that whole East Asian trade nexus sort of it went on hold, and it spread to the US and to Europe and so on. People are much more connected than we ever really thought, and there's actually this work going on at the OECD on that particular issue and on value added in trade, and I hope we'll get some good results out of that. But it is true that they can do more, they can drive themselves through more domestic demand. That is true. Of course, China can definitely do it. China has the fiscal space. It has the ability to be authoritarian about what it wants to do on monetary policy and on fiscal policy. And it will recover in the way I suggested because it will put more money into housing and infrastructure, and it's going to do that. And there is this developing middle class that will spend more and more. So we won't have those incredibly high savings rates in the future. We'll have more spending going on. And I mentioned the surplus has come down from 10% of GDP to 2% of GDP, the current account surplus. So, I mean, something can happen there, but that's not true of all countries. But, of course, China is a massive country in that area of the world. But, things have been a little bit better in Latin America and a little bit better in Africa, but, of course, it could all come to an end if the advanced economies, basically, if they dry up. I mean, as I said, the United States is actually growing a bit more, but Europe is, we have it in recession still, so that's very sad. Now, how long can the crisis go on, Michael? Well, I guess back in 2010, 2011, I thought we were recovering from the crisis and we were going to sort of take off. There were the green shoots. And then, we got the euro area crisis in spades, which is why I say, the epicenter now is really in Europe. It's affecting the rest of the world as well. It's affecting business confidence. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people, lots of companies sitting on lots of cash, but they're not spending it. So I don't know. I mean, we said about 18 months ago that we saw things then as a sort of, we had a sort of central scenario, but we thought it was a bimodal probability. Either things would get seriously worse, there'd be some really much, much worse crisis, or we would get a recovery. And the central one, which we didn't put much probability on, was actually what we called muddling through. Well, we've been muddling through ever since. And now that's where we are. And I can see this crisis going on for a long time. And we early on, actually, in the business, decided not to call it a financial crisis, but to actually call it a financial and economic crisis, because that's what it rapidly turned into, even though the origins were in the financial sector and a lot of the problems are there. And then just a couple of little things. I mean, on the G20, there was initial cooperation when things were very urgent and things were done, and there were the heads of state summits, and so there was the London summit, and then there was Obama in Chicago with everyone, and things were actually done. But then since then, there's been sort of really less. I mean, there have been meeting and having lots of working groups and so on. But there's not a lot of trust, I think. I mean, there's this issue of all these old issues on trade and industrial policy and currency wars.
I mean,
to jump in,
the trust has gone the other way. I mean, everywhere look in the world today, states and state elites trust each other less. Go to Asia, nobody trusts each other. Nobody trusts China, nobody trusts Japan. And there's still an underlying sense that fundamentally the United States won't lead and China can't. If you come into Europe, who's the leader? Germany doesn't want to do it. Everybody moans about the British. The Franco-German relationship is fragmenting before our very eyes. I mean, I'm not saying the crisis of humanity is always a crisis of leadership, but the issue of trust has gone. I mean, those early shoots of the new global governance, which were here in early 2009, I think we're further and further away from that, not closer. And that seems to me is also now a fundamental part of what we call the crisis, is it not?
Yeah. And then just two other very small things. This thing about the IMF crisis, yes. I sort of had heard about it, but I was amazed when I went to Seoul and I saw these big signs. Yeah, IMF sales.
That's right. Yeah,
all over the place. And then on AMRO.
IMF what?
IMF sales. Sales. Cut price sales.
If you're unemployed, it's because the IMF. You knew who to blame.
Yeah. And then on AMRO, and that's very interesting because AMRO has been wanting to come along to OECD meetings, actually, so we've had them down on our participants list, and I haven't looked to see whether we've put them as AMRO or we spelt out the letters.
Yeah, yeah, get the right.
Put AND or not put AND, but I'll have to have a look.
Robert, do you have any...
Yes, just on the global coordinator, nobody in the cockpit point. Yesterday, Thomas Pickering and David Hanney being the former UK ambassador to the UN, had an article in the Herald Tribune which said that the G20 needs to find a mission, it needs boosting. Unfortunately, they didn't really say how. They came up with a lame suggestion that the G20 needed to institute a troika arrangement whereby at any one time, there were three countries in the chair, that is, the outgoing chair, the present chair, and then the chair to come. That they would all be...
They do that already.
Well, that was the only concrete suggestion that they had.
Oh, well, that's done.
And it's already done.
My point is that it was a very feeble article. They didn't mention the question of an G20 secretariat, perhaps because this is a very controversial issue. The G7, at least many of the G7, want the OECD to be the secretariat, and many of the developing countries in the G20 absolutely do not want the OECD to be the secretariat for obvious reasons. However, my point is that these people, like everybody else, takes the existence of the G20 as presently constituted as given. The problem is that the G20 fundamentally lacks legitimacy. If not in the eyes of the members of the G20, then in the eyes of the 172 countries in the world that are permanently excluded from the G20. Remember, the G20 is a small club which was selected by the G7 in 1999. It has no representational system, with some marginal exceptions, like representatives of the African Union and one or two others are invited as observers, not as full members. The membership is permanent. That is, there is no arrangement for changing the membership as countries' economic weight, their systemic importance, changes. So, for example, Argentina is in there. Why is Argentina one of the world's 20 or 19 systemically important economies? It's not. Neither is Australia.
Nor is Russia.
Indeed. Well, maybe Russia. Mm. Russia has nuclear weapons. but the reason for Argentina is simply that in 1999, Carvalho, the finance minister, had been the roommate of Larry Summers, who was then US Treasury Secretary, and Larry told his deputy, Timothy Geithner, that of course his friend Carvalho had to come to the G20 meeting, so Argentina was invited. But it's in no sense a systemically important country compared to, for example, Spain. But anyway, I mean, I don't want to get into these specifics. The larger point is that there is no rationale for those 19 countries. You cannot reverse, I have tried, you cannot reverse engineer the membership of the G20. It was selected by the G7 on the basis of friends of friends. And the main point is that its membership is permanent. There's no mechanism for changing the membership like there is in the Security Council for the non-permanent members. Now, if you are interested in following this up, then the September issue of Global Policy, an excellent journal based at LSE, or was based at LSE, or is being divorced now from LSE because of the problems with LSE's relations with Gaddafi. But anyway, it has been an LSE journal. It's called Global Policy, and the September issue has a really interesting article by me on how to reform the G20 and replace it with a properly constituted Global Economic Council. It's all spelt out there.
And on that collective non-referential note, well done for getting it in there, Robert. I think it will be an excellent article because Robert always writes provocatively and interestingly.
The OECD's published its Spain economic survey today.
I've got an article coming out already in Chinese on the power shift. Do you want to do any self-publicity, Lawrence? You put academics together, and goodness, we'll just see what happens. Okay, I think we'll draw the proceedings to an end. I just want to, first of all, thank you all for staying and asking some really good questions. I'd like to thank also, secondly, our sponsors. Glad to see Australia's back in there. It is a member of G20, I believe.
Yes.
Good, because they sponsored our conference. So, therefore, a non-Australian state, but Ross Kelly and Dr. David Morgan. So, thank you to our sponsors. You always need good sponsors. Thanks to all our helpers from Ideas, and thanks to Ideas. They've done a great job, as always. Thanks to Ideas. I'm bound to say that because I helped run it. And finally, if we could give a good round of applause, not only to our speakers, but also to Francesco, who has done all the hard work, a lot of the hard work. It was his idea. It was his dream, but certainly his vision. And thanks for working very closely on this and bringing together what I think has been an extraordinarily successful day. So thank you all, and thank you again to all our speakers for this evening.